This is a Connectability Radio production.
Sensory Indications for a Child with Special Needs with Jennifer Rodanovich, Occupational Therapist with CODA. Part 1.
Good morning. Welcome to our first workshop of the day, Sensory Indications for Children with Special Needs. I want to say a great pleasure to introduce Jennifer Rodanovich. Jennifer is an OT working for CODA, and she has lots of other and she's been with CODA for 8 years and has been working on contracted community living in Toronto. So a lot of us have had the opportunity of working with Jennifer as well. And she leads parent workshops for the Jumpstart program at Geneva Center. And Jennifer is just wonderful, and I know you're going to get a lot of information this morning. So welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you. So good morning. Today we are going to talk about sensory processing, and I hope today you'll walk away with an appreciation of what it takes for children to do what they need to do during the day, and when they are having difficulty, why, and what we might be able to try and do to help them. Okay, and when we're talking about sensory processing, we are talking about the process that the nervous system uses sensory messages and turns them into responses. And responses means doing something. So whenever we are talking about moving, completing a task, sitting in circles, we are talking about the first step, which is the sensory processing part. Okay? Everything starts with your sensory processing skills. Okay? All behaviors and actions will be the result of how we process input, and therefore it is the foundation for the development of motor skills. And we spend a lot of our time in the day helping children develop their motor skills. So I think it's a very important topic. Okay? The sensory systems that we are going to talk about today are the 5 senses that we all know, as well as a couple of different ones. So we have auditory, which is our hearing, vision, olfactory, which is our smell, gustatory, which is our taste. And smell and taste are usually quite entangled. Tactile is our touch. And it's not just touch on our hands, but the way we perceive touch in the rest of our body, as well as inside of our mouth. Okay? Also, we are going to talk about vestibular input. And vestibular input is how we perceive movement. So when our head is tipped back to wash our hair, we are receiving vestibular input. Okay? If you are on a roller coaster, you will receive a lot of vestibular input. If you are sitting on the bench holding the bags while everyone else goes on the roller coaster, you're receiving less vestibular input. Okay? It's the way your body knows it's moving. Proprioception is pressure on your muscles and on your joints. So anytime you are receiving resistance, you are feeling your proprioceptive input. So if you are carrying a heavy bag, if you're leaning against the wall, if you're squishing yourself tightly into the corners of the sofa, you are receiving proprioceptive input. And we are going to talk a lot about proprioceptive input because it's a very, very powerful type of sensory input. And pain. Okay? We won't talk a lot about pain. It's a very difficult input for us to understand from a sensory processing perspective, but we will talk about it a little bit today. So I want to just give an idea of how when we're talking about sensory input, we won't only be able to talk about just one area, because usually the areas interact with each other, and they actually work together. So if, to demonstrate that, I'd like us all just to stand up for a moment. Okay. Make sure that you're going to be safe, okay? And we're going to put, we're going to stand on one foot, okay? If you can now, find a spot. Stand on one foot and then close your eyes. Okay? And then open your eyes. Okay? You can sit down now. Okay? So when we were standing on one foot, most of us were fine with that. Most of us didn't look unsteady. Okay? Then when we closed our eyes, some of us became more unsteady than we did before, and some of us stayed just fine. So we actually, when we're using our vestibular input, our feeling of balance and movement, this will happen a lot this morning. We also are using our vision. So when we are balancing our body, when we are feeling where our body is in space, we're also using our eyes to help us know that information. Okay? And if you are dependent on your vision to know where your body is, that will affect how you do some things in the day. So I didn't see everyone, but if anyone truly fell off and had to put their other foot down, that person would have been really depending on their vision to be able to do what I asked them to do. As soon as I take the vision away, they couldn't do it. So think about a child who needs to see their feet when they're walking in order to be able to walk or to climb the stairs. If we say, no, look up, look where you're going, we're actually taking away their strategy of trying to be safe. Or imagine the difficulty of a child being able to ride a bike by not looking at their feet. If you always look at your feet when you're pedaling, you're going to crash into the wall or into a friend. Okay? So that child is having difficulty knowing where their body is because they can't use their vision. Okay? So it's very interesting, I think, to see how these systems work together. We are going to talk about the sensory process. I want this to hopefully be interesting for you because I do think it's important to know the steps because difficulties with processing can occur at any stage. And I'm not expecting you to take this information and to be able to go back to your daycare and to be able to point a child out and say they are having difficulty with this stage. But I want you to have a basic understanding of the stages so that you can appreciate that children can have difficulty at one or more of these steps, okay? So that when the OT does come into the daycare to give you some assessment and some strategies, you will have an appreciation and an understanding of why they're suggesting what they're suggesting. And sometimes when we know why, we're able to follow through more consistently, right? So there are five steps: sensory registration, orientation, interpretation, organization of a response, and execution of a response. Essentially, every body goes through each step when they are reacting to something, whether it be the first ray of sunlight that your eyes feel in the morning, or whether you're crossing the street, or whether you're trying to get some paperwork done, you're going to go through every step. So the first step is sensory registration. That's a, what is that? That first, I can feel something. It could be noise, it could be touch, it could be feeling your body. It is threshold dependent. It means, threshold dependent means that there's a point where your body will say, what is that? And everyone's threshold is different, and it will change throughout the day. So if your threshold is low, it means that you will need only a little bit to be able to feel things. So if you're very sensitive to touch, your threshold is very low. You feel touch quite quickly. Okay? If your threshold is high, you need someone to give you the biggest bear hug in order to feel that hug. Alright? And depends. Doesn't matter where you are, your threshold will change throughout the day. An example would be one of my favorite examples is waking up in the middle of the night, you're going to get yourself a glass of water in the kitchen, and all of a sudden you hear the fridge make a funny noise. And you're like, is that a good noise or a bad noise? Right? And your threshold is different because you're awake, it's 2 o'clock, there's no more noises in the house. So your body's gonna pick up what's that a lot faster than at 5 o'clock when you're trying to make dinner and all the kids are running around wanting your attention, getting homework help. You probably didn't even hear the noise in the fridge. But the fridge probably was making the same noise. Okay? So we actually perceive things differently depending on our day and how we're feeling. Have we ever sort of fallen asleep on the couch with the TV on? And there's that moment where you're watching TV, but you think someone's turned the volume down, but no one's touched the volume? Because your threshold has changed because you're probably going to be falling asleep soon. Okay? So your threshold's up and down, but also you can have a threshold that is going to impact on how you react. If your threshold is very high, you're not going to pay attention to a lot of things. If your threshold is very low, you're going to pay attention to a lot of stuff. And we're going to talk about more of how that difficulty comes up. Okay? Also, I want to make sure we understand that our thresholds also are dependent on anxiety. Okay? How nervous we are about something. So an example I like to use is waiting for a doctor's appointment. A doctor that you have never seen before for a procedure that's pretty serious and you're a bit nervous about it. You're probably going to be able to pay attention to everyone that's walking into that waiting room. However, if it's your 10th time and it's routine and you're reading a book, you might not even lift your head when someone walks in the room. Okay, so anxiety, how comfortable you're feeling in your environment will also affect your threshold. So is a child able to register the crayon that's in their hand? Their ability to do that will depend on how they perform for you. Okay? And actually, our threshold and our registration changes with our lifespan. Not everybody, but it is more common for vestibular movements to become more sensitive to vestibular input as we get older. So if you loved roller coasters when you were 15, but now prefer not to go on them, you're normal. Okay? And it's actually your sensory system changing its registration. Okay? Not everyone does that, but it is quite normal. And that's why we don't like the rides we used to like. It's not that we're getting old and more too mature for those rides. It's that our body does not want that extra stimulation. So the next step is, do we pay attention? Because we're receiving a lot of stuff today, right? A lot of noise, a lot of cars driving by, the sun coming in. What do we pay attention to? Okay? Hopefully you're paying attention to my voice. Okay? It's the fridge. If you're getting that glass of water from a relative's kitchen, you may not pay attention to the noise in the fridge because it's not your fridge. And if it's broken, it doesn't matter to you, right? You're not going to have to get it fixed. So you're not going to actually attend to that noise. Okay? And we need to be able to decide what is relevant and what is not relevant. Obviously, we cannot think everything is relevant or else we can't do anything, right? We pay attention to too much and we get nothing done. Okay? An example of orientation is when I'm standing on the edge of this chair, okay? I need to pay attention to my vestibular input. I am needing to make sure I stay balanced, I don't fall off the chair. I'm not really paying attention to what I'm listening to, because that's not relevant for me right now. Okay? So my body is making a choice. If my body makes a choice to pay attention to what I'm hearing, I'm probably going to fall off the chair. Okay? So a child who might do a lot of wandering during free play, or picks up every other toy in the playroom but doesn't play with it, may be getting stuck in paying attention to everything in their environment. Okay? Which means they're not going to be able to move forward to the next step, which is actually doing something. Because we haven't actually gotten to doing something.
We've just gotten to the paying attention part, right? So finally we get to talk about what is going to be done. And to decide what to do, we have to use our memory, our language, and emotional skills. Like the fridge, we know the fridge is brand new. It's probably a sound we just didn't hear before. We're okay. All right, so we're going to use our past knowledge and our past information to decide what are we going to do. If you have trouble with emotions or memory or language or social skills, you may have a limited understanding of past experience. So you cannot use that to help you decide what to do. So if a child has a block in their hand and they cannot recall what it is used for, they will not be able to decide what to do with it. Okay? They might just do something else, like throw it, because they remember that's what they need to do. And then we need to choose something. So we know we need to do something. Something needs to be done. What are we going to do? We have to prepare to do it. So you need to use all those previous steps, and you need to get ready to do. You'll have to use your past experience to know what to do. And if you don't have past experience, again, it's going to make it difficult. For example, traveling in a new country and needing to, or a new city, and needing to find a detour that you're not familiar with the area, you're going to have a lot harder time organizing your response than if you are having to find a detour in Toronto. Okay, and the execution of response essentially is dependent on those first four steps. If you have any trouble with 1 through 4, 5 is not going to look very good. Actually, what you come up with and what actually you do is not going to look very coordinated, it's not going to look very functional, it's not going to look very smooth. Okay, so it's also dependent on motor planning, and we are going to talk about motor planning in a little bit. Okay? So it's a little bit dry, those steps, but I want to make sure we understand the complexity of sensory processing. It's really complicated, and really it is the basis for what we do. Because all of us have to go through 1 through 4 before we get to 5, which is doing. And a lot of what we spend our time with children in the day is focusing on this step. Come, let's do this, let's do that. What are you doing now? Okay, so if we're having trouble doing, we kind of need to look at the first four steps to figure out where the issue is. Okay? And we know that if you don't look into something further, you just keep asking this child to do the same thing over and over again, and it doesn't work. Alright? Or you've spent 6 months getting to do a puzzle, you've finally gotten it, but you just know in the back of your head that there probably was a more efficient way of doing it. That there was something that was missing that you couldn't identify, so you just persevered and just out of luck and time, they got to do the puzzle. But what if you look at the first four steps? It might help us be more efficient and more effective and make the process smoother for you and the child when we're asking them to do something. Any questions about that? No? Okay. If you do have any questions, please don't hesitate, raise your hand. I do like to answer questions and try and challenge me, okay? Mm-hmm. Ask me a difficult question, okay? So the results of sensory processing are twofold and are extremely important for a nice smooth day at the center. The first one is self-regulation. Self-regulation is the ability to stay calm when you need to stay calm and to be excited when you can be excited. And the ability to go back to calm when you are required to. You need to be able to attain a arousal level, maintain it, or change it depending on the day. So the ability to get excited about going outside, running around outside, having a high arousal level when you're outside, coming in and getting calm to sit in a circle to listen to a story. That is self-regulation. Okay? Also, the ability to keep it together during the day. Children tend to behave well when they are outside of their homes. They listen, they follow instructions, but sometimes when they get home, they fall apart. They don't listen, they might whine a lot. Mom might say, gosh, when they get home, they don't act the same way. Okay? It's actually a good self-regulation skill because the child's been able to behave appropriately when they have to, and when they don't have to, in the safety of their home, they can let it all out. And it's actually a good sign, okay? Especially for children who have other sensory issues, if they are showing this difference between home and daycare, it's actually showing some ability for them to self-regulate, okay? Although, for the parents probably don't think it's a good news, because they're the ones having to deal with the meltdown, but that's what moms and dads are for, and that's what happens, and that's why it's a good thing. It's a good thing, okay? We all go through it, so. motor planning, we are going to talk a little bit more detail again in a minute, but I want to make sure we address it today, right here. It is the process of formulating a plan, coming up with a plan, sequencing it, executing it, and it's usually a motor skill. It actually is only a motor skill. So, I was going to say reading, but reading you have to talk and you have to use your muscles. So, silent reading doesn't require motor planning. How's that? We are going to talk about motor planning again. If all your systems are working well, then you are able to adjust your level of arousal for the situation at hand and follow the necessary action. So you can pay attention to me today, get enough information so you can go back to work and tell everyone what we talked about. Feel free to do what you need to do today to change your arousal level. If you find your engine's running low, stand up. I have suckers that we will talk about if you are finding the need to get yourself awake. Okay? And do those things. Appreciate them, okay? Because I've got a high engine. My engine's running high because I'm talking to all of you. So I will not be sleepy. But I can appreciate, you know, the fact that you have to sit still. And most of you don't sit still at all day. So your bodies are probably in shock, okay? So we all do things. We all do things to change our arousal level. It keeps your engine calm. It's in a down, calm, alert state. So she can behave properly and wait in line, right? And not put things right? And if we are lucky, we will have quick little strategies that are going to be effective enough for us to keep our engine. But if we have such significant difficulties with self-regulation, we will have to find very extreme strategies, and usually that will cause us trouble, right? Okay, we can get old enough that we can keep it together during the day and do what we need to do at night, right? We all do things at home. We all change to comfy clothes, or maybe not, but some of us do. I know a young man told me once he had autism, and he did lots of flapping, but he was in high school, and he knew, he was very, very verbal, and he sat across the table from me, and I just talked to me like a client has never talked to me before, because most of my clients are too young to actually, you know, have a good conversation with. And he said that he has to flap, but he knows he doesn't want to do it in public. So he goes home, and he doesn't want to do it in front of his family because his parents used to tell him not to do it. So he has a shower. And so in the shower, he flaps his hands. And he does that for 15 minutes when he gets home, and then he's fine. So he still needs to do this, but he has been lucky enough to find a way to do it in an appropriate way. So the ultimate goal for us is to find, not to say, in my opinion, is not to say, no, don't do that, but no, don't do that here if it's inappropriate. Let's find a more appropriate way for us to do what we need to do. Okay? So we all use them.
But what if the child can't control it? And the more you talk to the child, it's going to make it worse because you're saying, well, don't do that. Can you not do that? It's inappropriate. The other children are watching them. So what do you do?
I think you would still want to come up with a strategy to encourage them to pick other choices, but you might not be able to introduce those other choices during the crisis. So you may want to, depending on what the child is doing and what they need for calming, which we will talk more about in a little bit, like the specific, but if you find out what they specifically need, then you can offer it to them and show them in a positive way how they can get what they need, and you can actually praise them for doing these things. Okay, and we can, when we talk about sensory diet, you can remind me if I don't mention it again, but we're not going to just do calming things when there's a crisis. We're going to do calming activities before the crisis comes, and if you see one coming, and even if you're having the best day ever, you're still going to do the calming things. It's not a reaction. So you're not going to get any success with a kid who's flaring around, hitting everybody, and say, okay, what do you need for calming? Well, obviously that's not going to work. But if you can come up with some things that we're going to talk about, then introduce it in calm time, introduce it in a routine, praise them for doing it, give them rewards for doing a good job making their engine better, and then when they get angry, then there's more of a chance of you being able to say, you're starting to get angry, your engine is starting to run high, let's go do a handstand. My most effective strategy for me is to do a handstand at the wall. I can show you what that looks like if you want. Most people go, yes, please. And then I have to tuck in my shirt. Yes. And then I do it. I'll do it over here. Because it's already marked on the wall. So it's not my shoes. Yeah, I'm not acrobatic, I'm not athletic, I can't do it. So you don't have to be, and a 2-year-old can do a handstand. Because they do teach this in gymnastics. And for 18 months to 2 years. So little ones can do this too. They just do this. Easy. I prefer not to put over like some people would do this way, but I might fall. So I do it the easy way. For me, my person, I need to do 3 handstands for as long as I can hold them. And if I do that, I can feel my engine going down. So if something's happened in the day that gets me frustrated, I just have to go over and do my handstands, and then I will come back and my face won't be as red and I'll be calm and then I can deal with the situation. So for me, that is the what I have to do when I'm most frustrated. Okay? The purpose of this exercise was to give us an appreciation of what we all do. There's probably not a person in this room that doesn't have at least one strategy that they use to either get themselves to be more awake or to calm themselves down. So we all do it. We're just here to figure out how to help those kids who have made choices that are inappropriate, okay? But we have to appreciate why they've made that choice, because then we can make the next step forward with coming up with strategies to help them, okay? So not, no, don't chew that toy, but yes, come and chew this chewer. And the reasons why, and as he would say, please let them chew this chewer. Okay, we're not listening. We know that we don't want this child biting or chewing toys, but we also need to know that that child is doing it for a really important reason. Okay. So the results of a sensory processing disorder, when you're having difficulty, and I think the numbers are 50% of children with autism have sensory processing difficulties, and I believe it's 10% of typically developing children. Okay? Sensory processing difficulties have been connected with ADD and ADHD and learning disabilities,
I'm not sure if those children are considered typically developing, but I would have to say that 10% is probably a rough estimate. And there's probably a lot of children out there that do have sensory processing difficulties, but have been identified as something else, like behavioral problems, that we don't capture. So I would think that as the research continues, that 10% of the general population will go up. Now, if you don't like tags in the back of your shirt, and you go home and you cut them off every time you buy a new shirt, and then you feel comfortable, that's not considered a sensory processing difficulty because you found a quick solution and there's no residual issues afterwards. However, if you cut the tags out of your shirt and you avoid messy play and you avoid clothes and textures on a consistent basis that stop you from purchasing clothes that you would like, that would be considered a sensory processing difficulty. So it has to do with the extent and the severity on how it interferes in your day. If someone touching you lightly causes you pain and that affects your social interactions, that would be considered a sensory difficulty. Okay? So I don't want you to think that just cutting the tags out of your shirt means you've got something like sensory processing disorder, but it could if it's in the package. Okay? So hopefully you might have an understanding now when I say that when you have difficulties with sensory processing, you might under or over respond to input. So we talked about that first step, registration. You might over or under. If you over respond to input, you feel it fast and furious, and you have to react firmly. You only need a little bit to feel a lot. It's a missed message. It's an inaccurate message from the brain. Someone touches me lightly here. My brain says, someone's touching you. Someone's touching you. Watch out. Watch out. That is an over-responsive. That's a missed message. Because in reality, someone is just touching me without any worry. Okay? Under-responsiveness is someone touching me like this, and I'm not feeling it. Until they squeeze harder, then I go, oh, someone's touching me. Okay. Or a child who has a spoon in their hand, and it's held very limply, and they don't really do anything with it. It just seems kind of useless to them. They may be under-responsive, because they actually, their brain is not picking up that something significant is in their hand. So we need to change that missed message so that the message is, hey, there's a spoon in your hand and you can do something with it. Okay? A child who is unable, if the message is inaccurate, if the message is inaccurate, then your performance is going to be inaccurate. Right? If you have misinformation, you will not be able to make the right choice. So if you have misinformation about how you're pushing on the pedal, and your brain is saying, yes, you're pressing hard enough, but you're really not, you're not going to change what you do. You're just going to sit there on the tricycle, and it's not going to go anywhere. And the teacher's going to say, come on, Johnny, push, push, push. And you're going to wonder, why are they keep asking you to push the pedal? Because I'm pushing them. It's just not working. Right? So if we change the message, then the child can say, oh, I need to change what I'm doing. I need to push harder. Okay? A child who's unable to pull their boot off because they're pulling as hard as they can and they don't know why the boot's not working. Because they're not getting the right message. The message is not, they're not being told by their brain to push harder, pull harder. Okay? Or a child who feels that the sandpaper is very scratchy and painful, and that some teacher has put really sharp pieces in the sandpaper. Well, that is an over-response to input, and that child will not be putting their hands in the sandbox. And that missed message stops them from enjoying that activity. So, especially
when you are over responsive to input, when you feel it very intensely, you're going to feel things as threatening. Because I do not touch people to be threatening. But if they will perceive it that way. Okay? Light touch can be perceived by children as being very threatening and scary. Because it's a mixed message that the brain is sending, alert, someone is attacking you. Okay? So if any of us received a message from our brain that someone was attacking us, we would definitely attack back. Right? Who here would not defend themselves? Okay? So light touch can be painful, can be perceived as being painful, and can be perceived as being threatening for some children who are over-responsive, and it can create aggression, anxiety, okay, fear, avoidance. And as I'm saying again, I need to appreciate that they are doing this for a very specific reason. They are only reacting to the message that they're receiving. So essentially, of course, we need to change that message, right? Because we don't want them to be thinking that we're attacking them all day. But that could be their reality, okay? We'll keep going. But let me know if I don't give you what you're looking for. If we have a light plastic spoon, their child may not even know how to control it because they cannot feel it, versus a heavier metal spoon, okay? Children who have difficulties organizing their information, they may pay attention to irrelevant objects. They may pay attention to the wheels of the car instead of the car because they are not able to differentiate what is important and what is not important. And that, again, is going to affect their play skills. We're going to wonder why they're not pushing the car. Well, because the car is not important to them. It makes sense. They're doing what they're supposed to be doing. We have to change that so that they can actually enjoy and play and learn. Difficulty planning actions. Okay? We do a lot of planning in our day. An example for us now would be if you roll a ball to the child, are they able to plan and sequence when they have to lift their leg and when they have to kick it? So they have to use their senses and they have to use their processing to figure that out. And if the message is wrong, they will miss the ball. And they probably will not have a backup plan if they don't succeed. And then we might run away. And they don't want to play anymore because they don't know what else to do. Modulation difficulties is essentially those first three steps, the ones where we're just getting information, haven't done anything yet. In this modulation difficulties, we're going to have children who are going to shut down, or they might overstimulated. We want to be careful when we are talking about sensory information. So, unfortunately, I'm going to give you ideas today, hopefully, things to think about, but I won't be able to give you definite answers because sensory information or difficulties are never a straight line. And my favorite example of that is a child who's sitting in the middle of the playroom not doing anything. They're just sitting there. Like if their eyes were not open, you'd think they were asleep, right? That child could be under-responsive, so there's not enough noise in the room for them to hear it. There's not enough visual stimulation for them to see it. Their body is kind of numb and doesn't really get that there's stuff going on. Okay? So they might be under-responsive. Or they could be so over-responsive that they're shut down. And shut down is not a good place for the body. It's not healthy for our sensory system to be shut down. So that child is shut down because there's too much noise. There's too much movement, there's too much stimulation, okay? So I could not say exactly what to do with that child if you told me, Johnny sits in the middle of the room and doesn't do anything. I have to take a look and see. Yes, ma'am.
that might be a trauma, though, that the child's gone through and that they're just not coping with life right now?
It could definitely be a psychological component. If we're talking, but I was sort of focusing more on the sensory stuff. But yeah, like if a child is, yeah, you don't know, and that's the big thing. And when you if you assume that a child is under responsive, and you go up to them and say, "Hey, Johnny, how you doing?" Oh, sorry, if they're over responsive, I'm sorry, that's just too much. You go, "Oh, Johnny, how you doing?" And you've added more input. That kid's going to go more into a shutdown, and you're going to do more damage. Okay. So if you do have a child like that and you really want to try something, I would err on the side of caution and take them to a quieter room and see if it makes them become more alert. If that child becomes more alert, more engaging, more playful, better eye contact, then you might be dealing with a child who is over-responsive. Okay? Because if you have a child who's under-responsive and you bring them to a quiet room, they're just going to say the same. So you haven't done anything wrong. Okay? This is an example of how sensory stuff is tricky, okay? And we are getting into the tricky part where you're going to be asking me all sorts of questions and I'm going to try and give you the best answers, but ultimately you want the OT to come and see this child that you're concerned about so they can give an accurate assessment of what's going on. But I still want you to ask the questions as we get into strategies, because then it will help you understand when those strategies are suggested to you. You might be able to follow through and find ways to incorporate them in your routine more effectively than if you didn't ask them. Okay? So please feel free to ask, but I would hesitate to go back and do a lot of some of these things. Okay? I'll highlight things that you can try. All right? Children may seek. They might actually be sensory seekers. They might actually run around and not be able to sit still, or they're seeking toys to chew. They might push up against all the kids, or lean against the staff in circle time. They're just really seekers. And sometimes children will be seekers in a way to try and reduce sensitivity. Okay? So moving around can help us attention, or it can help us. We already talked a little bit about how chewing helps us calm ourselves, and so they might be seeking because they are oversensitive. Okay, it's all connected. However, some children do seek, especially movement, and they seek, they have trouble shutting down. They have trouble closing the gate. So once input comes in, it comes in, and they have no way of closing that gate off, and they need help to figure out how to do that. And it's usually connected with movement, like the running, the jumping, the climbing, but there can always be a calming strategy with that. I'm not sure I'm getting everything I want here. So modulation difficulties are very common for children, and as we said, this is all stuff that's going to get in the way of their play, right? They're not going to be able to play if they're having to be, their bodies are distracted by being sensitive or undersensitive. We all work best when we are in a calm, alert state, and if we're not at that calm, alert state, we're not going to be able to pay attention, we're not going to be able to do what we need to do. And so we need to address this first, before we get that child to try and do the puzzle. Okay? So I would...
Can you explain oversensitive again? Mm-hmm. When you said if you take a child
out of the room. So if a child is oversensitive, so there's too much noise, too much movement, too much pictures on the wall, maybe too many children in the room that are rubbing against them, then they have shut down to protect their bodies. It's a protective reaction that our body does to preserve itself. And so if you remove that child from the room, and so you've reduced their noise, reduced the touch, reduced the movement, that child no longer has to be in shutdown and can start to come out of that and pay attention and look and feel more comfortable. You're just removing them from a position of discomfort. And we're just going to have a break now, but just before we go on the break, I want to I always have to say this, I'm sorry, it's my pet peeve, but about shutdown, when we all, some of us might have experienced shutdown in ourselves, but an infant, especially newborns, are very sensitive to their sensory system. I don't know if you've, like, hopefully you've heard before, this is the children education, but you know, you're not supposed to talk loudly to an infant and look at them because it's too much information. You should just make fun faces with them quietly or talk to them because it's too much information. So if you see a baby or if you have a little baby and you take them to a party and they fall asleep, please don't say, "Oh, what a cute baby. Sleep with all that noise. What a great baby." Most likely that baby is in shutdown. Okay? And so I do not like seeing babies at parties when they are sleeping because there is a really, really good chance that their body has gone into overload and has had to shut down, which is not healthy for our bodies. So we remove that baby from the noisy room into a quiet room and they all of a sudden wake up. You know that baby shouldn't be in that room. So I just like to advocate for all the newborns out there that it's just my biggest pet peeve when people say, "Oh, what a cute baby sleeping," and you know, at the sporting events and people bring their infants, and an audiologist would have a heyday, but you know, they are sleeping because their body cannot take any more, and it's a very unhealthy place to be. And while we're talking about shutdown, we'll talk about pain, because pain, if a child doesn't experience pain properly, if they don't experience it, they don't appreciate it, it is a flag for possible shutdown. So it means we really need to look at this child to reduce their shutdown response. So if a child falls and is bleeding all over and they don't seem to care, that is a real issue and is something that has to be looked at, and we have to look at the possibility of that child being in shutdown. Because not all children who are in shutdown fall asleep. They can be running around. They can be in shutdown all day, but not very productive. They're not going to be the ones that are going to be sitting quietly doing their work.